Welcome back to the Anglo-Omani Society podcast. Today we welcome Dr. Zahid Al-Mandhri, who is Head of Radiation Oncology at Sultan Qaboos Comprehensive Cancer Center. After graduating from the top of his class from Sultan Qaboos University, Dr. Al-Mandhri decided to focus on radiation oncology and started studying at the University of Alberta, where he finished his fellowship. Later, he joined the Royal Hospital in Oman as a radiation oncologist before his current role at the soon-to-open Comprehensive Cancer Center. In this podcast, we explore the development of the Sultan Qaboos Comprehensive Cancer Center, its future as its plans open, and the impact it will have on cancer treatment in Oman.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Al-Mandhri, for joining me on the Anglo-Omani Society podcast. I think your expertise and your knowledge will be a great boon to our listeners, so I look forward to speaking with you today. I was wondering if we could begin by just telling our listeners a bit about your background. Where did you study and how you became a doctor?
Well, I'm a graduate of Sultan Qaboos University Hospital, or university actually. I was one of the first, I was the seventh batch actually of graduates of Oman. So I'm batch number seven of first medical group. So when we joined the university, the first batch was graduating because, you know, at that time it took 7 years for you to become a doctor. So we got to see the first batch graduate from the university. After graduation, though, in 1999, I graduated the top of my batch. And at that time, the university used to take the top 10, and you were given an open ticket to study whatever you wanted in whatever specialization. And after speaking to Professor Mansoor, who was our mentor at that time in oncology, I decided to go into radiation oncology. It was sort of a risk at the time because there was no radiation oncology in Oman when I went to study, but there were plans to build a center. So I traveled to Canada and I did my residency and fellowship in Canada for another 6 or 7 years there. Then when I came back, the center was just opened in 2004. I joined them as a short, brief training in 2005 before I had finished. And I finished in 2007. So I joined the Royal Hospital in 2007 as a radiation oncologist there. So that's kind of my journey in medicine.
But it sounds like a lot of success and a lot of dedication as well. I was wondering, was there anything particular about oncology that attracted you to it? Or, I mean, apart from speaking with your advisor, was there anything that attracted you to it?
You know, at the time, I'm actually I like physics. So one of the areas that I was very strong in was mathematics and physics. I actually got an award in the university for medical physics. Our doctor at that time called me in his office and said, you know, I have never done this in my whole life of teaching. I have never given any student in my life a complete score. I tried to find a dot you had missed, a T you had not missed to cross. I tried to find a unit you forgot to mention, a way of answering that you did not highlight. There was nothing I could find wrong. So this was the first time in my life that I'm giving any student 100% out of 100%. So then I was awarded for that. So basically, physics was really a strong point for me. And radiation oncology involves a lot of physics. So, and that was sort of the input that I got. You know, you do have a talent in physics, and this is an area that you would actually do very well in. And so that's how I chose radiation oncology.
Oh, wow. That's, I mean, incredible. As someone who was not very good at maths or physics in school, to hear that is incredible. I was wondering, was your desire to become a doctor, did that exist before you went to university, or was it something that developed, I guess, later in your life?
Well, it was sort of a surprise for everyone when I graduated. Initially, everyone thought I would go into IT because I also do have a talent in information technology. It was one area that I thought, especially after working in the IT field, I was able to do so many things without actually going to college as a student in secondary school. And I just, with my interaction with the guys who were actually doing programming and working with hardware, I just thought that I wouldn't learn much more if I went to to the university. And so I thought that my calling was more in towards helping people, and that's how I chose to go into the medical field. But initially, it was sort of a surprise even for my whole family. They thought I was definitely going to be an engineer, and to be a computer engineer in particular. But I did still carry on my passion, and I think in 2 years ago, I won the first prize in innovation award in Oman for a project that I did in prevention of medication error, which is basically a software that uses blockchain, etc., to track changes in patients' medications. And that is a way to identify and to prevent medication errors in patients. So I won first prize in that. So I'm still quite passionate in IT, apart from my passion in medicine.
Wow. I mean, it sounds incredible in that you, it definitely seems one of your passions is also helping people. And even when you're developing those IT programs, it's still with the goal of helping people. It's incredible. I wanted to move on to asking you about where you currently work and about the Sultan Qaboos Comprehensive Cancer Care and Research Center. Can you just tell our listeners a bit about what it is and why it's different maybe from other hospitals in Oman?
Yes, so the Sultan Qaboos Comprehensive Cancer Care and Research Center is a new center that's been built to serve cancer patients in Oman. We did have the National Oncology Center before that I was working in, but this center is definitely very much different in that we wanted to two things out of this center. One is to provide comprehensive cancer care. And when we talk about comprehensive, we really mean the word comprehensive. And I'll come to what I mean by that. But we also wanted this center to be a beacon of change in how you can actually provide healthcare in ways that puts the patient right in the center of care. The building was built from the ground up with research in mind and patient centricity in mind. Many a time a building is built and then people go and work in that building and they say, okay, this is a good facility, we should do research. This hospital is completely different in that, no, part of the DNA of even the building itself has research as part of it. We have a dedicated research wing for doing phase one and phase two trials. We have a dedicated research laboratory apart from our own laboratory. The main laboratory is actually very large. Actually, it's one of the biggest laboratories in Oman. But we also, in addition to that, we have a research laboratory, just to put things into perspective. And then patient centricity is really key. And that's what we want to sort of bring to healthcare, in that we're using technology, and that's sort of where the passion of my IT comes in. So we're using technology and we're using best practice and merging them together in a way that serves the patient best. I can give you a brief example of, when we talk about how we organized our outpatient, where we see patients in the clinic. Usually when you go to hospitals, you will find the doctor's name on the door. It says, this is the doctor's office or so-and-so. You go and see the doctor in that room. In our hospital, it's no. The rooms don't belong to the doctors. They belong to the patient. So the patient walks into the room and sits there. The doctor actually comes and sees them in the room, greets them. And all services are done right there in the room, from their vitals, from them seeing the doctor, them seeing the nurse, seeing a clinical psychologist, them seeing a clinical pharmacist, and the list goes on, social worker, pain management. They get all the services provided in that particular room. When they leave the room, they're basically going home. And then we're also organized in programs. So for me, for example, I'm in the GI program. And in the GI program, you have not just the radiation oncologist, you have the medical oncologist, you have the surgeons, you have the social worker who's specifically for, you have occupational therapy, you have physiotherapy, you have all of these people are in the same clinic and the patient gets to see them rather than, oh, you need medical oncology appointment. So I'll put an appointment for you. You'll see him after two. No, we're all in the same clinic. So the patient gets to see all the services, gets their services, basically increasing efficiency by a huge amount. There are many examples of this that I can give you from my previous hospital and the new hospital, where we've cut, you know, weeks of appointments by just having the patient seen in that same day. So really an amazing thing to experience. And we hope that we're able to sort of ooze this change in other hospitals and so that we can start to see a change in how we deliver healthcare.
Oh, that sounds really incredible. And especially the patient-focused aspect of it, the fact that, like you were saying, that all the different doctors or specialists come to them is, I'm sure a lot of people listening would love to have that in the healthcare system. And I just on that point, really, I just wanted to ask, in one of the interviews you've given before, you talked about the holistic treatment. And I think you mentioned there as well, the comprehensive treatment that patients get. I think a lot of us think of cancer treatment as chemotherapy and then done, but it seems there's a lot more to it. And the hospital seems to provide a lot more from what you're saying.
Yeah, for sure. I'll just give you a small fact that, you know, when you talk about nutrition and cancer, you'll find that most patients who end up dying from cancer are malnourished. And is it because they died because of malnourishment? Or is it because they died because of the cancer is advanced? That kind of, it just shows you that nutrition plays a very important role in cancer care. And many other aspects of cancer care tend to be ignored when we just focus on the treatment alone. And that's why you need all these team members working together, because the patient is not just the cancer. There are many aspects to the patient. Some are related to his personal relationship with his family. So we have all the support that they can get from the hospital. Some are related to their diet and nutrition. Some are related to their physical activity. Some are related to even their environment at home. And that's why we have occupational therapy involved. So this whole in patient support services, group therapy, and so on. So really, a patient isn't just their disease. And when you start treating patients with all these other facets, you get very surprising results from them. And this has been shown in various studies, even including something like a study done in palliative care, which showed that when you have early introduction of palliative care, patients live longer, which sort of is interesting. This was done in lung cancer in particular. And you can see that it's not just the chemotherapy and the treatments that we're giving. It's everything. If you put everything together, patients tend to do better. And that's a fact. In addition, you look at exercise and breast cancer. There are many studies, again, showing that when you introduce a routine exercise program, patients are able to tolerate chemotherapy better. They have better outcomes. Not only that, the recurrence of tumors are less. So when you put all this together, you have to treat the patient with not just the treatment of chemotherapy. You need to include everything in order to get the best results for the patient. And that's what we're aiming for, is to give the best results to our patients.
Well, I mean, it sounds like that you are, and that your aim in that is definitely being fulfilled. And it seems that the hospital itself is quite a landmark in a lot of the things that you're saying. How long has this been in development, and when was the official opening date of the hospital?
Okay, that's a good question. First of all, the official opening date is not yet open. But we have started, we've started seeing patients in the hospital, obviously. And we're opening services as we speak. The first service to open was the radiation oncology department, where we started to treat patients in radiotherapy. But then we've expanded to radiology, to outpatient, to daycare. And next week, we're going to be opening inpatient care. So that will be the sort of the top of the line of where we're finishing. And then obviously, surgery is about to open at the end. Once we open all of the services, we'll be looking at the official inauguration. So right now, we're just opening the services as the areas are getting ready. It's a challenge, you know. It's a hospital that was built over 4 years and also built during a time when there was COVID. And we had to work all around that scenario of a pandemic. So from the perspective of the timeline of being built to the opening of the center, I think we have done an incredible job. Not that I'm praising ourselves, but I think it really was a challenge. And the construction company, you know, they had things like multiple teams staying in different places of camps when they came to work. And if one team was down, you had two other teams that were still working in other parts of the hospital. So really, they made sure that if the pandemic hits, it's not going to hit every aspect of the project. So that was during construction. And then we had recruitment, which was really a challenge. Everybody that I've spoken to who has opened a center in this period has had issues with recruitment, because it's not easy to find people, especially, again, during a pandemic when there is high demand for us, or nurses in particular. But we've been blessed with a success also in recruitment. So in that short period of time, we've not just built the center, we've recruited the staff required to run the center, and we've opened the center. So really a big achievement in terms of the timeline.
Well, and touching upon what you were saying before in terms of recruiting people, how large in terms of departments and staff and people needed to run the hospital?
The hospital, obviously, again, being a comprehensive center, you can imagine that we have everything. When I mean everything, we have all the facilities that we require to serve our patients. So we have cardiologists, we have nephrologists. So it's really a multi-specialty team of doctors. When a patient is admitted in the hospital, although they are receiving chemotherapy for cancer and they've been admitted with a chest infection, they have the best care while they're inpatient, where they will be seen by a pulmonologist, they'll be seen by an infectious disease doctor. They're not just being treated by an oncologist who might be very good at treating cancer, but might not be the best in treating a chest infection. So you get the idea. So we do have, being a comprehensive center, the staff that's required to have that title of comprehensive is obviously quite big. But I think the payoffs of it are also very big in terms of how long does a patient stay in hospital? What is the cost of having patients coming multiple times to hospital because they're not receiving the best care? The cost of moving from one hospital to another. So I think we've struck somehow a mix of or a balance between cost and effectiveness. And I think more we're towards more of the efficiency and cost effectiveness rather than cost exuberance. So I think we do have a formula where we are able to deliver care in an efficient way and serve our patients at the same time cut costs.
I mean, it really sounds like everything has been thought through from patient side to the administration side. So it sounds very detailed. And I actually wanted to ask in terms of cancer treatment in Oman, Germany, how much do you think the center will change how cancer is treated and how cancer is prevalent in wider Omani society?
If you look at the statistics from WHO, they state that we're going to have I would call it a tsunami of cancer patients coming up in the coming years. And that's because of how lifestyles have changed. Huh? And the focus has been towards non-communicable diseases until the pandemic hit. But in general, we are expecting a big surge in cancer care cases in the world. The bad news is that the biggest increase in the number of cancer cases is actually going to be happening in our part of the world, in the developing and underdeveloped world. And that's because that in this part of the world, we have a lot of young population and they're growing older, while in the more mature developed world, we have a more flattened population pyramid, I would call it. The increase is not going to be as big. They already have a big problem right now in terms of the cancer cases. But for us, we have a very big young population that's not going to remain young forever. We wish so, but that's not going to happen. You know, this very large young population is getting older and older. And as you get older, the rates of developing cancer by virtue of your age, not by virtue of the risk factors, actually goes up. There is a direct relationship between age and risk of developing cancer. So that's one factor. Obviously, there are other factors that are competing with this fact, but the biggest factor contributing to the increase in number is actually aging. The other factors, obviously, pollution and other things, and developing other diets and habits that generally, you know, sedentary lifestyle, fast food chains, and so on, that are happening in this part of the world now more than before. Even cigarette smoking, for example, wasn't an issue in Oman. It's becoming more prominent in certain parts, including shisha and so on. So these are issues that will create their own set of problems in addition to what we're going to be seeing with the increase in age. So we needed to be prepared for this. And this center is part of that plan of preparedness. It's not the only plan. Obviously, we're not expecting that this center will take over the cancer care in the whole country. The National Oncology Center should, and not only should, it should actually expand in services. If you look at, looking at what is expected in the number of cancer care cases that are coming up. But we also have the expandability. This building was built so that we do have the option of expanding. There is a phase two and a phase three that's already in the blueprints. So we know if we need to add, for example, additional linear accelerators, radiotherapy machines, we know this is how it's going to be done. This is the blueprints already there. Everything has been planned for the next 30 years. So this building has been built to cater for the services for the next 30 years and to be expanded to cover those services in the next 30 years. But not alone. The other centers should come up. We should see more centers in Oman, in places like Sohar and places like Salalah, which are distant-wise, and also population density is quite high. So those areas should start to see their own centers showing up. In order for us to really cater for all cancer care in Oman. But definitely this is a big help for the current situation. If you just look at the IEA recommendations of how many linear accelerators, for example, that's required per population, the minimum requirement is for every million, you require one linear accelerator. We already have two in Royal and we have two here, plus a cyber knife. So that's kind of, if you look at the population of Oman, that's where we are now. That's not going to be the situation 3 or 4 or 5 years from now. The population is definitely going to grow. We need to build more.
I didn't know some of those statistics and what the World Health Organization was saying, but you touched upon actually one of the things I wanted to ask you about in this regard is the use of technology and how the center and I guess Oman generally, but how technology is being used to combat the prevalence of cancer.
Yes. So technology is really key in how we will first identify cancer early. So things like using AI in breast in mammography, for example, is really one of the advances that we're seeing in the current number of years, where an AI is as good or even a slightly better than a radiologist who has been trained for years in reading mammograms. But we're using this artificial intelligence as aids in diagnosis. So in general, we don't usually depend on one radiologist anyway to read a mammogram. We require two certified radiologists to read mammograms for breast cancer. And obviously, getting two people who are highly trained is difficult, but you can replace one of them with an AI. And you save in terms of number of human resources you require, but still get very good, maybe even better results with a radiologist and an AI working together. So using those in early detection, but also we're using AI in our center in decision support. So if you have a patient who has a particular diagnosis, particular stage, particular markers, the system can actually tell you that these are the options that are available. And if the patient has a good performance status, then this is the preferred option. If the patient has impaired renal function, this is the preferred option. If the patient has this is the preferred option. You select that option, it goes into and goes into the next level and populates all the orders for you. So gone are the days where I sit and write the day-by-day orders and just select a particular protocol and it does everything for you. And you can do the adjustments of dose, etc. So really very intuitive workflow to help patients or help doctors actually achieve their and decrease mistakes even because we're still human. So you decrease mistakes, you increase standardization of care because they will be all through a protocol and that's updated every time there's a new paper that comes out that tells you, no, this is now the new standard of care. So all of this is really live decision support for patients. So technology really plays a role there. But in addition to that, technology plays a role even making patients' life easier. For example, your food, if you are eating and your weight is going down, for example, I see someone who to me looks healthy. He's 80 kilograms, but 2 months ago he was 100, but I didn't see him 2 months ago. He looks to me healthy, but he lost 20 kg in 2 months. So that's not a healthy loss of weight. So a system will be smart enough to say, listen, you know, even though the weight looks, according to the BMI, looks nice, he's actually lost quite a lot of weight. And if we don't do something, maybe the next 2 months he's going to be at 60 and be completely malnourished. So the systems can identify things like this, identify patients before they become septic and where they can end up in ICU. We can detect them much earlier. So really, this is a use of technology to identify and work on catching patients early. And then the other aspect is patient comfort. You know, you walk into your room. When you sit in the room, you see a screen that tells you welcome so-and-so to the center. You have your schedule there. When a doctor walks into the room, it highlights who that person is on your screen. You can order your meals using your screen. So all of this, you can look at educational material using your screen, and it's tailored to your needs and your diagnosis. All of these are uses of technology. So we're using it in diagnosis, we're using it in therapeutics, and we're using it in patient care.
Wow. I mean, it's good to hear the use of technology in such a beneficial way. And I wanted to actually, because we've been talking about some of the big issues, I wanted to move on to sort of Oman's approach towards cancer generally. And I wanted to ask you, how do you see Oman's approach at a societal or even government level? How do you see the approach to cancer in Oman right now?
So Oman sort of follows this 5-year plans on, but definitely the last 5-year plan has a huge emphasis on cancer and early detection in the Ministry of Health. And they're focusing on the big cancers that we're seeing most of, which are your breast cancer, colorectal cancer, and prostate cancer. These are the three that are really high. So the emphasis now is to how do we screen and how are we going to detect these cancers early. There is sort of a guideline, again, done by WHO on screening programs. And you can't sort of just photocopy and say, you know, there's a nice program being used, say, in the UK, and say, oh, we're going to do that in Oman. And there are many examples of that have failed miserably because of that approach. One is because the population is very different. And if you're going to do any screening program, people have to accept the screening program, one. They have to be willing to come voluntarily on a yearly basis to be screened, right? And they have to accept that modality of screening that you're going to do, that they feel that it's a good thing to do for them. And if you don't have that compliance, you might have the best equipment. And if the patients don't come to your screening centers, then your screening program fails miserably. So what they're doing now is testing out various models of screening. We do have a big challenge in our region because a lot of the cancer patients we are seeing, especially breast cancer, are fairly younger than, say, what we see in the UK. The median age is much younger. It's a whole 10 years younger than what has been seen in the UK, actually. And that's, again, partly because our population is very young. So if you have many people who are young, then you're likely to find cancer to be in the younger age group. So that's the situation we're in. And if you want to do a program, should I do a program for when the women in another 20 years will be in that age group that's required for us to do screening, or should we do a program of what we're seeing right now? And if we're going to do a program of what we're seeing right now, will what's happening in the UK apply to us? The simple example is mammography. If you know, the recommendation is you start this at the age of 40. Some countries do yearly, some countries do by every 2 years to decrease the dose on the breast. But if we look at the median age we see, or the youngest, the median age we see is around 40, or even less than that, 39 or 38. So we're supposed to catch cancer before they become cancerous. So you need to screen 10 years before that, right? So if you're screening before that, I can't use mammography because it's not going to work in the age of 30 or 35. It's not possible. Options that are available would be MRI. MRI is too expensive to do and as a screening tool. So then these are the questions that need to be answered in order for us to choose first a modality that works for the country and also that would target the population that are at risk in Oman. So this is the focus right now in Oman, is trying to find this. So there are various pilot studies that are in various parts of Oman, some in the interior, some in other parts, where they're using both mammography and some are using a clinical breast examination as an option. They're trying to figure out what's the best approach. And then the next step would be to basically do a mass deployment of these screening programs to try and detect cancers early. And we know if we detect cancers early, the cure rates are much higher.
Well, that makes sense. And it's anticipated actually my next question, which I presume it would have been your answer, but in terms of what you think should change for cancer treatment, would it just be the approach to screening and not using a fit model from another country, or are there other things that you would like to see?
Well, you know, actually, one thing that's really interesting is what's happening right now. And this is the challenge I think everyone is facing. You know, when we had COVID, you had the ICUs are full. Some hospitals shut down services for elective care, for example, surgeries, etc. Patients who would normally go for their routine screening were afraid to even go to the hospital for a mammogram. Why should I go and risk myself, stay at home? So all of these have impacted what we're currently seeing in the at the moment. And that's not just in Oman, that's everywhere in the world. We're having a surge of cases that have gone up, and we're also seeing cases that are at a later stage than previously. And that's just because of what has happened in the last 2 years. So it's a huge challenge that in the next 1 or 2 years, we have to catch up with what's been happening from COVID before we sort of refocus and start tackling the early detection again. And because we're really somewhere in between right now, and not just in Oman, the whole world. So I think we're in a unique situation for the next year, or maybe more than that, before we realign. And that's not just in Oman, the whole world is in the same situation.
No, it definitely seems we're in the short term, we're going to have to catch up in terms of healthcare, in terms of what COVID has done. And it seems that you're talking about a lot about the fear of people, for instance, coming into hospitals during COVID. And I wanted to ask you, in a sense, we've talked a lot about, I guess, the hospitals and the doctors, but what would you like to see regular people do in terms of the approach to cancer and cancer treatment? And is there a need for public education and public awareness?
Yeah, public education and public awareness is definitely key. And it's clear, if you look at the history of Oman, we had smoking, for example, was taboo. You know, everywhere in the world, people are now, the cessation of smoking, and we are seeing the positive effects of that with lung cancer going down, etc. But in Oman, we were sort of in a unique situation where just one or two areas in Oman where people actually smoked. If you lit a cigarette somewhere in other regions, you would have people looking at you awkwardly. And so it was really taboo. And we were, and even you compare Oman to, say, Yemen or the countries in the region, we don't have as high lung cancer or oral cavity cancers or laryngeal cancer or esophageal cancer, etc. all of these are related to smoking. That's just a reverse of what we had in Oman previously, is exactly what people are trying to do now with education and awareness, getting people aware. You know, if you quit smoking, these are the health benefits. If you eat healthy, these are the health benefits. So we were there, we were there before, and now people are catching up on these habits. So we really need to ramp up on our community education and to tell people that they need to change their way of life. In Oman, we have a huge percentage of diabetes. That's over 11% of the population. That's really very high. And again, because we're becoming more sedentary lifestyle, etc. When previously, we were, you know, if you wanted to get water, you need to walk a distance to get water from somewhere. Now you just open a tap, obviously. We're living in the modern world now. But the old world that people used to live in had its challenges for sure in terms of communicable diseases, malaria, etc. But they did not have a problem with non-communicable diseases because people lived quite healthy with exercise. Then everybody would walk at least 5 kilometers a day because of just by virtue of them getting to do things. You know, it's not they were doing exercise; they had to do that in order to have a living. So. And their diet was, you know, very well organized, and they didn't used to eat meat on a daily basis. You know, the diet's completely changed. So diabetes was something that, you know, maybe some of the rich people who had our lifestyle in that time had, and the general public did not even know about diabetes. So our lifestyle has changed. So we really need to work on bringing back some of those values, not making people work hard. I mean, in terms of you going out to do exercise voluntarily, not, you know, in order to work hard to get a living or shut off the water so you can go get water from somewhere else. No, but, I mean, people need to start working, thinking of their health and taking care of themselves, because it really makes a difference, not just for cancer, for all the diseases, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, etc. All of these will have a huge impact on the economy of the country if we don't control them.
Now, it definitely seems to be one of the paradoxes of modern life, that luxury in some ways is a curse as well as a benefit. But one of the questions, I guess, in this realm in terms of public education and trying large-scale movements to help with the treatment of cancer, are there ways in which regional countries in the GCC do currently work together or can work together in the future in terms of cancer treatment? It seems to be one of the trends of COVID, and I wonder if it's true for cancer as well.
Yes, well, we do have the Gulf Federation for Cancer Control, which is based in Kuwait, works together with the other countries in the region to during awareness campaigns. For example, in February, they create media messages that we all sort of work on as a region to promote, etc. So they also have a medical journal where people publish medical information in. So the Gulf have this forum the oncology team joins hands in promoting health awareness. They also carry and conduct, or they used to anyway, conduct a lot of screening campaigns, for example, for oral cancer in Yemen. They used to go as a campaign, volunteer doctors from various countries go there to help identify oral cancers early, and also get them to have treatment. Then they carry various campaigns for mammography, screening for education of girls in school. They create material for that to be used in the various schools in the region. So fairly active in trying to promote for prevention of cancer. And this is sort of a joint Gulf program, the GFCC, Gulf Federation for Cancer Control.
It sounds incredible, and I hope it continues. And it sounds like an incredible way to tackle such a large-scale problem.
First of all, cancer is obviously a global issue. It's not just in Oman. Cancer treatments are becoming more and more expensive, which is really a challenge overall that we need to somehow find a way to mitigate. And if we don't, I think all governments are going to be bankrupt because they're really getting to become more expensive and more specific for the patient. You know, we identify a particular marker and there's a specific drug that works on a particular marker. Before, we used to say, you have this particular cancer, this is the treatment. Now, no. It's this particular cancer, we look at the cells, we look at the genetic makeup of those cells, and then we say, okay, this is the best treatment for you, which is good in a way, but it's actually the costs of this are growing out of proportion of what most governments can actually support. So I really hope that someday in the future we can find a way to deliver this very highly tailored treatment to patients in a more cost-effective way. Really, that's really our dream as oncologists. If we can achieve that goal, then I think the so-called cure for cancer is more closer to be achieved. And that requires, obviously, collaboration throughout the world, governments, drug companies, etc. There are many movements towards sort of open-source research on particular drugs and patents rather than closed patent study or research. So those are sort of movements trying to decrease the costs of these new medications coming up. So I hope that we do find as humanity a solution, because obviously cancer cost is really one of the major problems in our world and even in the Western world. Many patients or people become bankrupt in the last years of their life because of trying to pocket or pay for very expensive care that insurance will no longer cover because they've already paid for so much more. So this is happening everywhere in the world, and somehow we have to find a solution for that.
I mean, I think that's a great way to end, but also, I mean, we could have a whole nother hour's discussion, I feel, on those points, and maybe sometime in the future, the Anglo-Mind Society can catch up with you again and discuss those points. It was a great pleasure speaking with you. I'm thankful for you dedicating so much of your time for this podcast, and I hope that you enjoyed the discussion.
Yeah, very much so. Thank you very much for having me.
We really hope you enjoyed this podcast. If you'd like to get in touch and learn more about the Cancer Centre, please email us and head to ao-soc.org. Thank you for listening.